he found himself wondering if they wouldn't all be better off dead, and shied away from the thought skittishly. But wasn't it true? The thought was inexorable. The pain in his feet would double, perhaps treble, before the end came, and the pain seemed insupportable now. And it was not even pain that was the worst. It was the death. The constant death. The stink of carrion that had settled into his nostrils. The crowd's cheers were a constant background to his thoughts. The sound lulled him. He began to doze again. And this time it was the image of Jan that came. For a while, he had forgotten all about her. In a way, he thought disjointedly, it was better to doze than to sleep. The pain in his feet and his legs seemed to belong to someone else, to whom he was tethered only loosely, and with just a little effort he could regulate his thoughts, put them to work for him. He built her image slowly in his mind. Her small feet. Her sturdy but completely feminine legs. Small calves swelling to full earthy peasant thighs. Her waist was small, her breasts full and proud. The intelligent rounded planes on her face. Her long blonde hair. Whore's hair, he thought it, for some reason. Once he had told her that. It had simply slipped out, and he thought she would be angry, but she had not replied at all. He thought she had been secretly pleased. It was the steady, reluctant contraction in his bowels that raised him this time. He had to grit his teeth to keep walking at speed until the sensation had passed. The fluorescent dial on his watch said it was almost 1 o'clock. Oh God, please don't make me have to take a crap in front of all these people. Please, God, I'll give you half of everything I get if I win. Only please constipate me. Please. Please. His bowels contracted again, strongly and hurtfully, perhaps affirming the fact that he was still essentially healthy in spite of the pounding his body had taken. He forced himself to go on until he had passed out of the merciless glare of the nearest overhead. He nervously unbuckled his belt, paused, then grimacing, shoved his pants down with one hand held protectively across his genitals, and squatted. His knees popped explosively. The muscles in his thighs and calves protested screamingly and threatened to knot as they were bullied unwillingly in a new direction.
Warning! Warning, 47!
John! Hey, Johnny, look at that poor bastard over there!
Pointing fingers, half seen and half imagined in the darkness. Flashbulbs popped, and Garrity turned his head away miserably. Nothing could be worse than this. Nothing. He almost fell on his back and managed to prop himself up with one arm. A squealing, girlish voice.
I see it! I see his thing!
Baker passed him without a glance. For a terrifying moment, he thought it was all going to be for nothing anyway, a false alarm. But then it was all right. He was able to take care of business. Then, with a grunting half-sob, he rose to his feet and stumbled into a half-walk, half-run, cinching his pants tight again, leaving part of him behind to steam in the dark, eyed avidly by 1,000 people.
Bottle it! Put it on your mantle! The shit of a man with his life laid straight out in the line. This is it, Betty. I told you we had something special in the game room. Right up here, over the stereo. He was shot 20 minutes later.
He caught up with McVries and walked beside him, head down.
Tough? McVries asked.
There was unmistakable admiration in his voice.
Real tough, Garrity said, and let out a shivery, loosening sigh.
I knew I forgot something.
What?
I left my toilet paper home. McVries cackled.
As my old granny used to say, if you ain't got a cob, then just let your hips slide a little freer.
Garrity burst out laughing, a clear, hearty laugh with no hysteria in it. He felt lighter, looser. No matter how things turned out, he wouldn't have to go through that again.
"Well, you made it," Baker said, falling in step.
"Jesus," Garrity said, surprised.
"Why don't all you guys just send me a get-well card or something?"
"It's no fun with all those people staring at you," Baker said soberly. "Listen, I just heard something. I don't know if I believe it. I don't know if I even want to believe it."
"What is it?" Garrity asked.
"Joe and Mike, the leather jacket guys everybody thought was queer for each other, they're Hopis. I think that was what Scram was trying to tell us before, and we weren't getting him. But, see, what I hear is that they're brothers."
Garrity's jaw dropped.
"I walked up and took a good look at them," Baker was going on. "And I'll be goddamned if they don't look like brothers."
"That's twisted," McVree said angrily. "That's fucking twisted. Their folks ought to be squatted for allowing something like that."
"You ever know any Indians?" Baker asked quietly.
"Not unless they came from Passaic," McVree said. He still sounded angry.
"There's a Seminole reservation down home across the state line," Baker said. "They're funny people. They don't think of things like responsibility the same way we do. They're proud and poor. I guess those things are the same for the Hopis as they are for the Seminoles. And they know how to die."
"None of that makes it right," McVree said.
"They come from New Mexico," Baker said.
"It's an abortion," McVree said with finality, and Garrity tended to agree.
Talk flagged all up and down the line, partially because of the noise from the crowd, but more, Garrity suspected, because of the very monotony of the turnpike itself. The hills were long and gradual, barely seeming like hills. Walkers dozed, snorted fitfully, and seemed to pull their belts tighter and resign themselves to a long, barely understood bitterness ahead. The little clots of society dissolved into threes, twos, solitary islands. The crowd knew no fatigue. They cheered steadily with one hoarse voice. They waved unreadable placards. Garrity's name was shouted with monotonous frequency, but blocks of out-of-staters cheered briefly for Barkovich, Pearson, Wyman. Other names blipped past and were gone with the speeding velocity of snow across a television screen. Firecrackers popped and spluttered in strings. Someone threw a burning road flare into the cold sky, and the crowd scattered, screaming, as it pinwheeled down to hiss its glaring purple light into the dirt of a gravel shoulder beyond the breakdown lane. There were other crowd standouts. A man with an electric bullhorn who alternately praised Garrity and advertised his own candidacy to represent the 2nd District. A woman with a big crow in a small cage, which she hugged jealously to her giant bosom. A human pyramid made out of college boys in University of New Hampshire sweatshirts. A hollow-cheeked man with no teeth in an Uncle Sam suit, wearing a sign which said, "We gave away the Panama Canal to the communist niggers." But otherwise, the crowd seemed as dull and bland as the turnpike itself. Garrity dozed on fitfully, and the visions in his head were alternately of love and horror. In one of the dreams, a low and droning voice asked over and over again, "Are you experienced? Are you experienced? Are you experienced?" And he could not tell if it was the voice of Stebbins or of the Major. Chapter 12. Somehow it had got around to 9 in the morning again. Ray Garrity turned his canteen over his head, leaning back until his neck popped. It had only just warmed up enough so you could no longer see your breath,
and the water was frigid, driving back the constant drowsiness a little. He looked his traveling companions over. McVries had a heavy scrub of beard now, as black as his hair. Collie Parker looked haggard, but tougher than ever. Baker seemed almost ethereal. Scram was not so flushed, but he was coughing steadily, a deep, thundering cough that reminded Garrity of himself long ago. He had had pneumonia when he was 5. The night had passed in a dream sequence of odd names on the reflectorized overhead signs. Veezy. Banger. Herman. Jampton. Winterport. The soldiers had made only 2 kills, and Garrity was beginning to accept the truth of Parker's cracker analogy. And now bright daylight had come again. The little protective groups had reformed, walkers joking about beards, but not about feet, never about feet. Garrity had felt several small blisters break on his right heel during the night, but the soft, absorbent sock had buffered the raw flesh somewhat. Now they had just passed a sign that read, Augusta 48, Portland 117.
It's further than you said, Pearson told him reproachfully.
He was horribly haggard, his hair hanging lifelessly about his cheeks. I'm not a walking road map, Garrity said.
Still, it's your estate.
Tough.
Yeah, I suppose so.
There was no rancor in Pearson's tired voice.
Boy, I'd never do this again in 100,000 years.
You should live so long.
Yeah.
Pearson's voice dropped.
I've made up my mind, though. If I get so tired and I can't go on, I'm gonna run over there and dive into the crowd. They won't dare shoot. Maybe I can get away.
It'd be like hitting a trampoline, Garrity said. They'll bounce you right back onto the pavement so they can watch you bleed. Don't you remember Percy?
Percy wasn't thinking, just trying to walk off into the woods. They beat the dog out of Percy, all right.
He looked curiously at Garrity.
Aren't you tired, Ray?
Shit, no. Garrity flapped his thin arms with mock grandeur. I'm coasting. Couldn't you tell?
I'm in bad shape, Pearson said, and licked his lips. I'm having a hard job just thinking straight, and my legs feel like they got harpoons in them all the way up to...
McVries came up behind them. Scram's dying, he said bluntly. Garrity and Pearson said, huh? In unison. He's got pneumonia, McVries said. Garrity nodded.
I was afraid it might be that.
You can hear his lungs 5 feet away. It sounds like somebody pumped the Gulf Stream through them. If it gets hot again today, he'll just burn up.
Poor bastard,
Pearson said, and the tone of relief in his voice was both unconscious and unmistakable.
He could have taken us all, I think. And he's married. What's his wife gonna do?
What can she do? Garrity asked. They were walking fairly close to the crowd, no longer noticing the outstretched hands that strove to touch them. You got to know your distance after fingernails had taken skin off your arm once or twice. A small boy whined that he wanted to go home. I've been talking to everybody, McVries said. Well, just about everybody. I think the winner should do something for her.
Like what?
Garrity asked. That'll have to be between the winner and Scram's wife. And if the bastard Welshes, we can all come back and haunt him.
Okay, Pearson said. What's to lose?
Ray?
All right, sure.
Have you talked to Gary Barkovich? That prick? He wouldn't give his mother artificial respiration if she was drowning.
I'll talk to him, Garrity said.
You won't get anywhere.
Just the same. I'll do it now.
Ray, why don't you talk to Stebbins, too? You seem to be the only one he talks to.
Garrity snorted. I can tell you what he'll say in advance.
No?
He'll say why, and by the time he gets done, I won't have any idea.
Skip him, then.
Can't.
Garrity began angling toward the small, slumped figure of Barkovich.
He's the only guy that still thinks he's going to win.
Barkovich was in a doze. With his eyes nearly closed and the faint peach fuzz that coated his olive cheeks, he looked like a put-upon and badly used teddy bear. He had either lost his rain hat or thrown it away.
Barkovich.
Barkovich snapped awake.
What's the matter? Who's that?
Garrity?
Yes, listen. Scram's dying.
Who? Oh, right. Beaver Brain's over there. Good for him.
He's got pneumonia. He probably won't last until noon.
Barkovich looked slowly around at Garrity with his bright black shoe-button eyes. Yes, he looked remarkably like some destructive child's teddy bear this morning.
Look at you there with your big earnest face hanging out, Garrity. What's your pitch?
Well, if you didn't know, he's married, and...
Barkovich's eyes widened until it seemed they were in danger of falling out.
Married? Married? Are you telling me that numbskull is... Shut up, you asshole, he'll hear you. I don't give a sweet fuck. He's crazy.
Barkovich looked over at Scram, outraged.
What did you think you were doing, numbnuts? Playing gin rummy?
He screamed at the top of his lungs. Scram looked around blearily at Barkovich and then raised his hand in a half-hearted wave. He apparently thought Barkovich was a spectator. Abraham, who was walking near Scram, gave Barkovich the finger. Barkovich gave it right back and then turned to Garrity. Suddenly, he smiled.
Ah, goodness, he said. It shines from your dumb hick face, Garrity. Passing the hat for the dying guy's wifey, right? Ain't that cute?
Count you out, huh? Garrity said stiffly. Okay. He started to walk away. Barkovich's smile wobbled at the edges. He grabbed Garrity's sleeve.
Hold on, hold on. I didn't say no, did I? Did you hear me say no?
No.
No, of course I didn't.
Barkovich's smile reappeared, but now there was something desperate in it. The cockiness was gone.
Listen, I got off on the wrong foot with you guys. I didn't mean to. Shit, I'm a good enough guy when you get to know me. I'm always getting off on the wrong foot. I never had much of a crowd back home. In my school, I mean. Christ, I don't know why. I'm a good enough guy when you get to know me, as good as anyone else. But I always just, you know, seem to get off on the wrong foot. I mean, a guy's got to have a couple of friends on a thing like this. It's no good to be alone, right? Jesus Christ, Garrity, you know that. That rank. He started it, Garrity. He wanted to tear my ass. Guys, they always want to tear my ass. I used to carry a switchblade back at my high school on account of guys wanting to tear my ass. That rank. I didn't mean for him to croak. That wasn't the idea at all. I mean, it wasn't my fault. You guys just saw the end of it, not the way he was ripping my ass, you know?
Barkovich trailed off. Yeah, I guess so, Garrity said, feeling like a hypocrite. Maybe Barkovich could rewrite history for himself, but Garrity remembered the rank incident too clearly. Well, what do you want to do anyway? You want to go along with the deal?
Sure, sure.
Barkovich's hand tightened convulsively on Garrity's sleeve, pulling it like the emergency stop cord on a bus. I'll send her enough bread to keep her in clover the rest of her life. I just wanted to tell you, make you see. A guy's got to have some friends.
A guy's got to have a crowd, you know? Who wants to die hated? If you got to die, that's the way I look at it.
Sure, right. Garrity began to drop back, feeling like a coward, still hating Barkovich, but somehow feeling sorry for him at the same time. Thanks a lot. It was the touch of human in Barkovich that scared him. For some reason, it scared him. He didn't know why. He dropped back too fast, got a warning, and spent the next 10 minutes working back to where Stebbins was ambling along.
Ray Garrity, Stebbins said. Happy May 3rd, Garrity.
Garrity nodded cautiously. Same goes both ways.
I was counting my toes, Stebbins said companionably. They are fabulously good company, because they always add up the same way. What's on your mind?
So Garrity went through the business about Scram and Scram's wife for the second time, and halfway through, another boy got his ticket. Hell's Angels on Wheels stenciled on the back of his battered jeans jacket, and made it all seem rather meaningless and trite. Finished, he waited tensely for Stebbins to start anatomizing the idea.
Why not? Stebbins said amiably. He looked up at Garrity and smiled. Garrity could see that fatigue was finally making its inroads, even in Stebbins.
You sound like you've got nothing to lose, he said.
That's right, Stebbins said jovially. None of us really has anything to lose. That makes it easier to give away.
Garrity looked at Stebbins, depressed. There was too much truth in what he said. It made their gesture towards Scram look small.
Don't get me wrong, Garrity, old chum. I'm a bit weird, but I'm no old meanie. If I could make Scram croak any faster by withholding my promise, I would. But I can't. I don't know for sure, but I'll bet every long walk finds some poor dog like Scram and makes a gesture like this, Garrity. And I'll further bet it always comes at just about this time in the walk, when the old realities and mortalities are starting to sink in. In the old days, before the change and the squads, when there were still millionaires, they used to set up foundations and build libraries and all that good shit. Everyone wants a bulwark against mortality, Garrity. Some people can kid themselves that it's their kids. But none of those poor lost children. Stebbins swung one thin arm to indicate the other walkers and laughed. But Garrity thought he sounded sad.
They're never even going to leave any bastards.
He winked at Garrity.
Shock you?
I guess not.
You and your friend McVree stand out in this motley crew, Garrity. I don't understand how either of you got here. I'm willing to bet it runs deeper than you think, though. You took me seriously last night, didn't you? About Olson.
I suppose so, Garrity said slowly. Stebbins laughed delightedly.
You're the bee's knees, Ray. Olson had no secrets.
I don't think you were ribbing last night.
Oh, yes, I was.
Garrity smiled tightly.
You know what I think? I think you had some sort of insight, and now you want to deny it. Maybe it scared you.
Stebbins' eyes went gray.
Have it how you like it, Garrity. It's your funeral. Now, what say you flake off? You got your promise.
You want to cheat it. Maybe that's your trouble. You like to think the game is rigged, but maybe it's a straight game. That scare you, Stebbins?
Take off.
Go on, admit it.
I admit nothing, except your own basic foolishness. Go ahead and tell yourself it's a straight game.
Thin color had come into Stebbins's cheeks.
Any game looks straight if everyone is being cheated at once.
You're all wet, Garrity said, but now his voice lacked conviction. Stebbins smiled briefly
and looked back down at his feet. They were climbing out of a long, sway-backed dip, and Garrity felt sweat pop out on him as he hurried back up through the line to where McVries, Pearson, Abraham, Baker, and Scram were bundled up together, or more exactly, the others were bundled around Scram. They looked like worried seconds around a punchy fighter.
"How is he?"
Garrity asked.
"Why ask them?"
Scram demanded. His former husky voice had been reduced to a mere whisper. The fever had broken, leaving his face pallid and waxy. "Okay, I'll ask you."
"Ah, not bad,"
Scram said. He coughed. It was a raspy, bubbling sound that seemed to come from underwater.
"I'm not so bad. It's nice what you guys are doing for Kathy. A man likes to take care of his own, but I guess I wouldn't be doing right to stand on my pride. Not the way things are now."
"Don't talk so much," Pearson said. "You'll wear yourself out."
"What's the difference? Now or later, what's the difference?"
Scram looked at them dumbly, then shook his head slowly from side to side.
"Why'd I have to get sick? I was going good. I really was. Odds on favorite. Even when I'm tired, I like to walk. Look at folks, smell the air. Why? Is it God? Did God do it to me?"
"I don't know," Abraham said. Garrity felt the death fascination coming over him again and was repulsed. He tried to shake it off. It wasn't fair, not when it was a friend.
"What time is it?"
Scram asked suddenly, and Garrity was eerily reminded of Olson.
10:10, Baker said.
"Just about 200 miles down the road," McVries added.
"My feet ain't tired," Scram said. "That's something."
A little boy was screaming lustily on the sidelines. His voice rose above the low crowd rumble by virtue of pure shrillness.
"Hey, Ma! Look at the big guy! Look at that moose, Ma! Hey, Ma! Look!"
Garrity's eyes swept the crowd briefly and picked out the boy in the first row. He was wearing a Randy the Robot t-shirt and goggling around a half-eaten jam sandwich. Scram waved at him.
"Kids are nice," he said. "Yeah, I hope Kathy has a boy. We both wanted a boy. A girl would be all right, but you guys know. A boy. He keeps your name and passes it on. Not that Scram's such a great name."
He laughed, and Garrity thought of what Stebbins had said about bulwarks against mortality. An apple-cheeked walker in a droopy blue sweater dropped through them, bringing the word back. Mike, of Mike and Joe, the Leather Boys, had been struck suddenly with gut cramps. Scram passed a hand across his forehead. His chest rose and fell in a spasm of heavy coughing that he somehow walked through.
"Those boys are from my neck of the woods," he said. "We all could have come together if I'd known. They're Hopis."
"Yeah," Pearson said. "You told us."
Scram looked puzzled.
"Did I? Well, it don't matter. Seems like I won't be making the trip alone anyway. I wonder."
An expression of determination settled over Scram's face. He began to step up his pace. Then he slowed again for a moment and turned around to face them. It seemed calm now, settled. Garrity looked at him, fascinated in spite of himself.
"I don't guess I'll be seeing you guys again."
There was nothing in Scram's voice but simple dignity.
"Goodbye."
McVries was the first to respond.
"Goodbye, man," he said hoarsely. Good trip.
Yeah, good luck, Pearson said, and then looked away.
Abraham tried to speak and couldn't. He turned away, pale, his lips writhing.
Take it easy, Baker said. His face was solemn.
Goodbye, Garrity said through frozen lips. Goodbye, Scram. Good trip. Good rest.
Good rest?
Scram smiled a little.
The real walk may still be coming.
He sped up until he had caught up with Mike and Joe, with their impassive faces and their worn leather jackets. Mike had not allowed the cramps to bow him over. He was walking with both hands pressed against his lower belly. His speed was constant. Scram talked with them. They all watched. It seemed that the three of them conferred for a very long time.
Now what the hell are they up to?
Pearson whispered fearfully to himself. Suddenly, the conference was over. Scram walked a ways distant from Mike and Joe. Even from back here, Garrity could hear the ragged bite of his cough. The soldiers were watching all three of them carefully. Joe put a hand on his brother's shoulder and squeezed it hard. They looked at each other. Garrity could discern no emotion on their bronzed faces. Then Mike hurried a little and caught up with Scram. A moment later, Mike and Scram did an abrupt about face and began to walk toward the crowd, which, sensing the sharp ting of fatality about them, shrieked, unclotted, and backed away from them as if they had the plague. Garrity looked at Pearson and saw his lips tighten. The two boys were warned, and as they reached the guardrails that bordered the road, they about-faced smartly and faced the oncoming half-track. Two middle fingers stabbed the air in unison.
I fucked your mother and she sure was fine, Scram cried.
Mike said something in his own language. A tremendous cheer went up from the walkers, and Garrity felt weak tears beneath his eyelids. The crowd was silent. The spot behind Mike and Scram was barren and empty. They took second warning, then sat down together, cross-legged, and began to talk together calmly. And that was pretty goddamn strange, Garrity thought as they passed by, because Scram and Mike did not seem to be talking in the same language. He did not look back. None of them looked back. Not even after it was over. Whoever wins better keep his word, McVree said suddenly. He just better. No one said anything. Chapter 13. 2 in the afternoon.
You're cheating, you fuck, Abraham shouted.
I'm not cheating, Baker said calmly. That's $1.40 you owe me, turkey.
I don't pay cheaters.
Abraham clutched the dime he had been flipping tightly in his hand.
And I usually don't match dimes with guys that call me that, Baker said grimly, and then smiled. But in your case, Abe, I'll make an exception. You have so many winning ways, I just can't help myself.
Shut up and flip,
Abraham said.
Oh, please, don't take that tone of voice to me, Baker said abjectly, rolling his eyes. I might fall over in a dead faint.
Garrity laughed. Abraham snorted and flicked his dime, caught it, and slapped it down on his wrist.
You match me.
Okay.
Baker flipped his dime higher, caught it more deftly, and, Garrity was sure, palmed it on edge.
You show first this time, Baker said.
Nuh-uh, I showed first last time.
Oh shit, Abe, I showed first 3 times in a row before that. Maybe you're the one cheating.
Abraham muttered, considered, and then revealed his dime. It was tails, showing the Potomac River framed in laurel leaves. Baker raised his hand, peeked under it, and smiled.
His dime also showed tails.
That's $1.50 you owe me.
My God, you must think I'm dumb, Abraham hollered. You think I'm some kind of idiot, right? Go on and admit it. Just taking the rube to the cleaners, right?
Baker appeared to consider.
Go on, go on, Abraham bellowed. I can take it.
Now that you put it to me, Baker said, whether or not you're a rube never entered my mind. That you're an idiot is pretty well established. As far as taking you to the cleaners, he put a hand on Abraham's shoulder. That, my friend, is a certainty.
Come on, Abraham said craftily. Double or nothing for the whole bundle, and this time you show first.
Baker considered. He looked at Garrity.
Ray, would you?
Would I what? Garrity had lost track of the conversation. His left leg had begun to feel decidedly strange.
Would you go double or nothing against this here fella?
Why not? After all, he's too dumb to cheat you.
Garrity, I thought you were my friend, Abraham said coldly.
Okay, $1.50, double or nothing, Baker said.
And that was when the monstrous pain bolted up Garrity's left leg, making all the pain of the last 30 hours seem like a mere whisper in comparison.
My leg, my leg, my leg, he screamed, unable to help himself.
Oh, Jesus, Garrity,
Baker had time to say. Nothing in his voice but mild surprise, and then they had passed beyond him. It seemed that they were all passing him as he stood here with his left leg turned to clenched and agonizing marble, passing him, leaving him behind.
Warning! Warning, 47!
Don't panic. If you panic now, you've had the course. He sat down on the pavement. His left leg stuck out woodenly in front of him. He began to massage the big muscles. He tried to knead them. It was like trying to knead ivory.
Garrity?
It was McVries. He sounded scared. Surely that was only an illusion.
What is it, Charlie horse?
Yeah, I guess so. Keep going, it'll be all right.
Time. Time was speeding up for him, but everyone else seemed to have slowed to a crawl, to the speed of an instant replay on a close play at first base. McVries was picking up his pace slowly, one heel showing, then the other. A glint from the worn nails, a glimpse of cracked and tissue-thin shoe leather. Barkovich was passing by slowly, a little grin on his face. A wave of tense quiet came over the crowd slowly, moving outward in both directions from where he had sat down, like great glassy combers headed for the beach.
My second warning, Garrity thought. My second warning's coming up. Come on, leg. Come on, goddamn leg. I don't want to buy a ticket. What do you say? Come on, give me a break. Warning. Second warning, 47.
Yeah, I know. You think I can't keep score? You think I'm sitting here trying to get a suntan?
The knowledge of death, as true and unarguable as a photograph, was trying to get in and swamp him, trying to paralyze him. He shut it out with a desperate coldness. His thigh was excruciating agony, but in his concentration, he barely felt it.
A minute left. No, 50 seconds now. No, 45. It's dribbling away. My time's going.
With an abstract, almost professorly expression on his face, Garrity dug his fingers into the frozen straps and harnesses of muscle. He kneaded. He flexed. He talked to his leg in his head.
Come on, come on, come on, goddamn thing.
His fingers began to ache, and he did not notice that much either. Stebbins passed him and murmured something. Garrity did not catch what it was. It might have been good luck. Then he was alone, sitting on the broken white line between the travel lane and the passing lane. All gone. The carny just left town, pulled stakes in the middle of everything in Blue Town. No one left but this here kid Garrity to face the emptiness of flattened candy wrappers and squashed cigarette butts and discarded junk prizes. all gone except one soldier, young and blonde and handsome in a remote sort of way. His silver chronometer was in one hand, his rifle in the other. No mercy in that face.
Warning! Warning 47! Third warning 47!
The muscle was not loosening at all. He was going to die. After all this, after ripping his guts out, that was the fact after all. He let go of his leg and stared calmly at the soldier. He wondered who was going to win. He wondered if McVries would outlast Barkovich. He wondered what a bullet in the head felt like, if it would just be sudden darkness, or if he would actually feel his thoughts being ripped apart. The last few seconds began to drain away. The cramp loosened. Blood flowed back into the muscle, making it tingle with needles and pins, making it warm. The blonde soldier with the remotely handsome face put away the pocket chronometer. His lips moved soundlessly as he counted down the last few seconds.
But I can't get up, Garrity thought. It's too good just to sit. Just sit and let the phone ring. The hell with it. Why didn't I take the phone off the hook?
Garrity let his head fall back. The soldier seemed to be looking down at him as if from the mouth of a tunnel or over the lip of a deep well. In slow motion, he transferred the gun to both hands, and his right forefinger kissed over the trigger, then curled around it, and the barrel started to come around. The soldier's left hand was solid on the stock. A wedding band caught a glimmer of sun. Everything was slow. So slow. Just hold the phone. This, Garrity thought. This is what it's like. To die. The soldier's right thumb was rotating the safety catch to the off position with exquisite slowness. Three scrawny women were directly behind him. Three weird sisters. Hold the phone. Just hold the phone a minute longer. I've got something to die here. Sunshine, shadow, blue sky. Clouds rushing up the highway. Stebbins was just a back now, just a blue work shirt with a sweat stain running up between the shoulder blades. Goodbye, Stebbins. Sounds thundered in on him. He had no idea if it was his imagination or heightened sensibility or simply the fact of death reaching out for him. The safety catch snapped off with a sound like a breaking branch. The rush of indrawn air between his teeth was the sound of a wind tunnel. His heartbeat was a drum, and there was a high singing, not in his ears, but between them, spiraling up and up, and he was crazily sure that it was the actual sound of brain waves. He scrambled to his feet in a convulsive flying jerk, screaming. He threw himself into an accelerating, gliding run. His feet were made of feathers. The finger of the soldier tightened on the trigger and whitened. He glanced down at the solid-state computer on his waist, a gadget that included a tiny but sophisticated sonar device. Garrity had once read an article about them in Popular Mechanics. They could read out a single walker's speed as exactly as you would have wanted, to four numbers to the right of the decimal point. The soldier's finger loosened. Garrity slowed to a very fast walk, his mouth cottony dry, his heart pounding at a trip hammer speed. Irregular white flashes pulsed in front of his eyes, and for a sick moment he was sure he was going to faint. It passed. His feet, seemingly furious at being denied their rightful rest, screamed at him rawly. He gritted his teeth and bore the pain. The big muscle in his left leg was still twitching alarmingly, but he wasn't limping. So far. He looked at his watch. It was 2:17 p.m. For the next hour, he would be less than 2 seconds from death. Back to the land of the living, Stebbins said as he caught up.
Sure, Garrity said numbly. He felt a sudden wave of resentment. They would have gone on walking even if he had bought his ticket. No tears shed for him. Just a name and number to be entered in the official records. Garrity, Raymond, number 47. Eliminated 218th mile. And a human interest story in the state newspapers for a couple of days. Garrity dead. Maine's own becomes 61st to fall. I hope I win, Garrity muttered. Think you will? Garrity thought of the blonde soldier's face. It had shown as much emotion as a plate of potatoes. I doubt it, he said. I've already got 3 strikes against me. That means you're out, doesn't it?
Call the last one a foul tip, Stebbins said. He was regarding his feet again.
Garrity picked his own feet up, his 2-second margin like a stone in his head. There would be no warning this time. Not even time for someone to say, "You better pick it up, Garrity. You're going to draw one."
He caught up with McVries, who glanced around. I thought you were out of it, kiddo, McVries said.
So did I.
That close?
About 2 seconds, I think.
McVries pursed a silent whistle. I don't think I'd like to be in your shoes right now. How's the leg?
Better. Listen, I can't talk. I'm going up front for a while.
It didn't help Harkness any.
Garrity shook his head. I have to make sure I'm topping the speed.
All right. You want company?
If you've got the energy.
McVries laughed. I got the time if you got the money, honey.
Come on then. Let's pick it up while I've still got the sack for it.
Garrity stepped up his pace until his legs were at the point of rebellion, and he and McVries moved quickly through the front runners. There was a space between the boy who had been walking second, a gangling, evil-faced boy named Harold Kintz, and the survivor of the 2 leather boys, Joe. Closer too, his complexion was startlingly bronzed. His eyes stared steadily at the horizon, and his features were expressionless. The many zippers on his jacket jingled, like the sound of faraway music. Hello, Joe, McVries said, and Garrity had an hysterical urge to add, What do you know?
Howdy, Joe said curtly.
They passed him, and then the road was theirs. A wide, double-barreled strip of composition concrete, stained with oil and broken by the grassy median strip, bordered on both sides by a steady wall of people.
Onward, ever onward, McVries said. Christian soldiers marching as to war. Ever hear that one, Ray?
What time is it?
McVries glanced at his watch.
2:20. Look, Ray, if you're going to...
God, is that all? I thought...
He felt panic rising in his throat, greasy and thick. He wasn't going to be able to do it. The margin was just too tight.
Look, if you keep thinking about the time, you're going to go nuts and try to run into the crowd, and they'll shoot you dog dead. They'll shoot you with your tongue hanging out and spit running down your chin. Try to forget about it.
I can't.
Everything was bottling up inside him, making him feel jerky and hot and sick.
Olson. Scram. They died. Davidson died. I can die too, Pete. I believe it now. It's breathing down my fucking back.
Think about your girl, Jan What's-Her-Face, or your mother, or your goddamn kitty cat, or don't think about anything. Just pick them up and put them down. Just keep on walking down the road. Concentrate on that.
Garrity fought for control of himself. Maybe he even got a little. But he was unraveling just the same. His legs didn't want to respond smoothly to his mind's commands anymore. They seemed as old and as flickery as ancient light bulbs.
He won't last much longer, a woman in the front row said quite audibly.
Your tits won't last much longer,
Garrity snapped at her, and the crowd cheered him.
They're screwed up, Garrity muttered. They're really screwed up. Perverted. What time is it, McVries?
What was the first thing you did when you got your letter of confirmation? McVries asked softly. What did you do when you knew you were really in?
Garrity frowned, wiped his forearm quickly across his forehead, and then let his mind free of the sweaty, terrifying present to that sudden, flashing moment.
I was by myself. My mother works. It was a Friday afternoon. The letter was in the mailbox and it had a Wilmington, Delaware postmark, so I knew that had to be it. But I was sure it said I'd flunked the physical or the mental or both. I had to read it twice. I didn't go into any fits of joy, but I was pleased. Real pleased. And confident. My feet didn't hurt then, and my back didn't feel like somebody had shoved a rake with a busted handle into it. I was one in a million. I wasn't bright enough to realize the circus fat lady is too.
He broke off for a moment, thinking, smelling early April.
I couldn't back down. There were too many people watching. I think it must work the same with just about everyone. It's one of the ways they tip the game, you know?
I let the April 15th back-out date go by, and the day after that, they had a big testimonial dinner for me at the town hall. All my friends were there, and after dessert, everyone started yelling, "Speech! Speech!" And I got out and mumbled something down at my hands about how I was going to do the best I could if I got in. And everyone applauded like mad. It was like I'd laid the fucking Gettysburg Address on their heads. You know what I mean?
Yes, I know, McVree said, and laughed. But his eyes were dark.
Behind them, the guns thunderclapped suddenly. Garrity jumped convulsively and nearly froze in his tracks. Somehow he kept walking. Blind instinct this time, he thought. What about next time?
Son of a bitch, McVree said softly. It was Joe.
What time is it? Garrity asked, and before McVree's could answer, he remembered that he was wearing a watch of his own. It was 2:38.
Christ.
His 2-second margin was like an iron dumbbell on his back.
No one tried to talk you out of it? McVries asked. They were far out beyond the rest now, better than 100 yards beyond Harold Kintz. A soldier had been dispatched to keep tabs on them. Garrity was very glad it wasn't the blonde guy.
No one tried to talk you into using the April 31st blackout?
Not at first. My mother and Jan and Dr. Patterson, he's my mother's special friend, you know. They've been keeping company for the last 5 years or so. They just kind of soft-pedaled it at first. They were pleased and proud because most of the kids in the country over 12 take the tests, but only 1 in 50 passes. And that still leaves thousands of kids, and they can use 200, 100 walkers and 100 backups. And there's no skill in getting picked, you know that.
Sure, they draw the names out of that cock-sucking drum.
Big TV spectacular.
McVries's voice cracked a little.
Yeah, the major draws the 200 names, but the names are all they announce. You don't know if you're a walker or just a backup.
And no notification of which you are until the final backout date itself, McVries agreed,
speaking of it as if the final backout date had been years ago instead of only 4 days.
Yeah, they like to stack the deck their way.
Somebody in the crowd had just released a flotilla of balloons. They floated up to the sky in a dissolving arc of reds, blues, greens, yellows. The steady south wind carried them away with taunting, easy speed.
I guess so, Garrity said. We were watching the TV when the major drew the names. I was number 73 out of the drum. I fell right out of my chair. I just couldn't believe it.
No, it can't be you, McVries agreed. Things like that always happen to the other guy.
Yeah, that's a feeling. That's when everybody started in on me. It wasn't like the first back-out date, when it was all speeches and pie in the sky by and by. Jan...
He broke off.
Why not? He'd told everything else. It didn't matter. Either he or McVries was going to be dead before it was over. Probably both of them. Jan said she'd go all the way with me, anytime, any way, as often as I wanted if I'd take the April 31st back out. I told her that would make me feel like an opportunist and a heel. And she got mad at me and said it was better than feeling dead. And then she cried a lot and begged me.
Garrity looked up at McVries.
I don't know. Anything else she could have asked me, I would have tried to do it. But this one thing, I couldn't. It was like there was a stone caught in my throat. After a while, she knew I couldn't say, yes, okay, I'll call the 800 number. I think she started to understand. Maybe as well as I did myself, which God knows isn't very well.
Then Dr. Patterson started in. He's a diagnostician, and he's got a wicked logical mind. He said, look here, Ray. Figuring in the prime group and the backups, your chance of survival is 50-1. Don't do this to your mother, Ray. I was polite with him for as long as I could, but finally I told him to just kiss off. I said I figured the odds on him ever marrying my mother were pretty long, but I never noticed him backing off because of that.
Garrity ran both hands through the straw thatch of his hair. He had forgotten about the 2-second margin.
God, didn't he get mad? He ranted and raved and told me if I wanted to break my mother's heart to just go ahead. He said I was as insensitive as a wood tick. I think that's what he said. Insensitive as a wood tick. Maybe it's a family saying of his or something, I don't know. He asked me how it felt to be doing the number on my mom and on a nice girl like Janice. So I countered with my own unarguable logic.
Did you? McVries said, smiling. What was that?
I told him if he didn't get out, I was going to hit him.
What about your mother?
She didn't say much at all. I don't think she could believe it. And the thought of what I'd get if I won, the prize, everything you want for the rest of your life, that sort of blinded her, I think. I had a brother, Jeff. He died of pneumonia when he was 6. And it's cruel, but I don't know how we'd have gotten along if he'd have lived. And I guess she just kept thinking I'd be able to back out of it if I did turn out to be prime. The major is a nice man, that's what she said. I'm sure he'd let you out of it if he understood the circumstances. But they squat them just as fast for trying to back out of a long walk as they do for talking against it. And then I got the call, and I knew I was a walker. I was prime.
I wasn't.
No?
No. 12 of the original walkers used the April 31st backout. I was number 12 backup. I got the call just past 11 p.m. 4 days ago.
Jesus, is that so?
Uh-huh. That close.
Doesn't it make you bitter?
McVries only shrugged.
Garrity looked at his watch. It was 3:02. It was going to be all right. His shadow, lengthening in the afternoon sun, seemed to move a little more confidently. It was a pleasant, brisk spring day. His leg felt okay now.
Do you still think you might just sit down?
He asked McVries.
You've outlasted most of them. 61 of them.
How many you or I have outlasted doesn't matter, I think. There comes a time when the will just runs out. Doesn't matter what I think, see?
I used to have a good time smearing away with oil paints. I wasn't too bad either. Then one day, bingo. I didn't taper off, I just stopped. Bingo. There was no urge to go on even another minute. I went to bed one night liking to paint, and when I woke up, it was nowhere. Staying alive hardly qualifies as a hobby. I don't know about that. How about skin divers, big game hunters, mountain climbers, or even some half-witted mill worker whose idea of a good time is picking fights on a Saturday night? All of those things reduce staying alive to a hobby. Part of the game. Garrity said nothing. Better pick it up some, McVries said gently. We're losing speed. Can't have that. Garrity picked it up. My dad has a half ownership in a drive-in movie theater, McVries said. He was going to tie me and gag me down in the cellar under the snack concession to keep me from coming, squads or no squads.
What did you do? Just wear him down?
There was no time for that. When the call came, I had just 10 hours. They laid on an airplane and a rental car at the Presque Isle Airport. He ranted and raved, and I just sat there and nodded and agreed, and pretty soon there was a knock on the door, and when my mom opened it, two of the biggest, meanest-looking soldiers you ever saw were standing on the porch. Man, they were so ugly they could have stopped clocks. My dad took one look at them and said, "Petey, you better go upstairs and get your Boy Scout pack." McVries jolted the pack up and down on his shoulders and laughed at the memory. And just about the next thing any of us knew, we were on that plane, even my little sister Katrina. She's only 4. We landed at 3 a.m. and drove up to the marker. And I think Katrina was the only who really understood. She kept saying, "Petey's going on an adventure." McVries flapped his hands in an oddly uncompleted way. They're staying at a motel in Presque Isle. They didn't want to go home until it was over, one way or the other. Garrity looked at his watch. It was 3:20. "Thanks," he said. "For saving your life again?" McVries laughed merrily. "Yes, that's just right." "Are you sure that would be any kind of a favor?" "I don't know." Garrity paused. "I'll tell you something, though. It's never going to be the same for me. The time limit thing. Even when you're walking with no warnings, there's only 2 minutes between you and the inside of a cemetery fence. That's not much time." As if on cue, the guns roared. The hold walker made a high gobbling sound, like a turkey grabbed suddenly by a silent stepping farmer. The crowd made a low sound that might have been a sigh or a groan or an almost sexual outletting of pleasure. "No time at all," McVries agreed. They walked. The shadows got longer. Jackets appeared in the crowd as if a magician had conjured them out of a silk hat. Once Garrity caught a warm whiff of pipe smoke that brought back a hidden, bittersweet memory of his father. A pet dog escaped from someone's grasp and ran out into the road, red plastic leash dragging, tongue lolling out pinkly, foam flecked on its jaws. It yipped, chased drunkenly after its stubby tail, and was shot when it charged drunkenly at Pearson, who swore bitterly at the soldier who had shot it. The force of the heavy caliber bullet drove it to the edge of the crowd where it lay dull-eyed, panting, and shivering. No one seemed anxious to claim it. A small boy got past the police, wandered out into the left lane of the road and stood there, weeping. A soldier advanced on him. A mother screamed shrilly from the crowd. For one horrified moment, Garrity thought the soldier was going to shoot the kid as the dog had been shot, but the soldier merely swept the little boy indifferently back into the crowd. At 6 p.m.,
The sun touched the horizon and turned the western sky orange. The air turned cold. Collars were turned up. Spectators stamped their feet and rubbed their hands together. Collie Parker registered his usual complaint about the goddamn Maine weather. By 9:15, we'll be in Augusta, Garrity thought. Just a hop, skip, and a jump from there to Freeport. Depression dropped over him. What then? 2 minutes you'll have to see her, unless you should miss her in the crowd. God forbid. Then what? Fold up? He was suddenly sure Jan and his mother wouldn't be there anyway. Just the kids he had gone to school with, anxious to see the suicidal freak they had unknowingly nurtured among them. And the ladies' aide. They would be there. The ladies' aide had given him a tea 2 nights before the walk started, in that antique time. Let's start dropping back, McVree said. We'll do it slow. Get together with Baker. We'll walk into Augusta together. The original Three Musketeers. What do you say, Garrity?
All right, Garrity said. It sounded good.
They dropped back a little at a time, eventually leaving the sinister-faced Harold Kintz to lead the parade. They knew they were back with their own people when Abraham, out of the gathering gloom, asked,
"You finally decide to come back and visit the Poe folks?"
"Jesus, he really does look like him," McVree said, staring at Abraham's weary, 3-day bearded face, "especially in this light."
47 years ago,
Abraham intoned, and for an eerie moment, it was as if a spirit had inhabited 17-year-old Abraham.
Our father set forth on this continent. Ah, bullshit, I forget the rest. We had to learn it in 8th grade history if we wanted an A.
The face of a founding father and the mentality of a syphilitic donkey, McVree said sadly. Abraham, how did you get into a balls up like this?
Bragged my way in,
Abraham said promptly. He started to go on, and the guns interrupted him. There was the familiar mail sack thud.
That was gallant, Baker said, looking back. He's been walking dead all day.
Bragged his way into it, Garrity mused, and then laughed.
Sure.
Abraham ran a hand up one cheek and scratched the cavernous hollow under one eye.
You know the essay test?
They all nodded. An essay, why do you feel qualified to participate in the long walk, was a standard part of the mentals section of the exam. Garrity felt a warm trickle on his right heel and wondered if it was blood, pus, sweat, or all of the above. There seemed to be no pain, although his sock felt ragged back there.
Well, the thing was, Abraham said, I didn't feel particularly qualified to participate in anything. I took the exam completely on the spur of the moment. I was on my way to the movies and I just happened to pass the gym where they were having the test. You have to show your work permit card to get in, you know. I just happened to have mine with me that day. If I hadn't, I wouldn't have bothered to go home and get it. I just would have gone on to the movies, and I wouldn't be here right now, dying in such jolly company.
They considered this silently.
I took the physical, and then I zipped through the objective stuff, and then I see this 3-page blank at the end of the folder. Please answer this question as objectively and honestly as you can, using not more than 1,500 words. Oh, holy shit. I think. The rest of it was sort of fun. What a bunch of fucked up questions.
Yeah, how often do you have a bowel movement? Baker said dryly. Have you ever used snuff?
Yeah, stuff like that, Abraham agreed. I'd forgotten all about that stupid snuff question. I just zipped along, bullshitting in good order, you know, and I come to this essay about why I feel qualified to participate. I couldn't think of a thing. So finally some bastard in an army coat strolls by and says, 5 minutes, will everyone finish up, please? so I just put down I feel qualified to participate in the long walk because I am one useless SOB, and the world would be better off without me, unless I happen to win and get rich, in which case I would buy a Van Gogh to put in every room of my mansion and order up 60 high-class whores and not bother anybody. I thought about that for about a minute, and then I put in parentheses, I would give all my 60 high-class whores old-age pensions, too. I thought that would really screw them up. So a month later, I'd forgotten all about the whole thing. I get a letter saying I'm qualified. I damn near creamed my jeans.
And you went through with it? Collie Parker demanded.
Yeah, it's hard to explain. The thing was, everybody thought it was a big joke. My girlfriend wanted to have the letter photographed and get it turned into a t-shirt down at the shirt shack, like she thought I'd pulled the biggest practical joke of the century. It was like that with everybody. I'd get the big glad hand and somebody was always saying something like, "Hey, Abe, you really tweaked the major's balls, didn't you?" It was so funny, I just kept on going. I tell you, Abraham said, smiling morbidly, it got to be a real laugh riot. Everybody thought I was just gonna go on tweaking the major's balls to the very end, which was what I did. Then one morning I woke up, and I was in. I was a prime walker, 16th out of the drum, as a matter of fact. So I guess it turned out the major was tweaking my balls. An abortive little cheer went through the walkers, and Garrity glanced up. A huge reflector sign overhead informed them, Augusta, 10.
You could just die laughing, right? Collie said.
Abraham looked at Parker for a long time.
The founding father is not amused, he said hollowly.
Chapter 14. They had all pretty much agreed that there was little emotional stretch or recoil left in them. But apparently, Garrity thought tiredly as they walked into the roaring darkness along US 202 with Augusta a mile behind them, it was not so. Like a badly treated guitar that has been knocked about by an unfeeling musician, the strings were not broken, but only out of tune. Discordant. Chaotic. Augusta hadn't been like Old Town. Old Town had been a phony hick New York. Augusta was some new city, a once-a-year city of crazy revelers, a party-down city full of a million boogieing drunks and cuckoo birds and out-and-out maniacs. They had heard Augusta and seen Augusta long before they had reached Augusta. The image of waves beating on a distant shore recurred to Garrity again and again. They heard the crowd 5 miles out. The lights filled the sky with a bubble-like pastel glow that was frightening and apocalyptic, reminding Garrity of pictures he had seen in the history books of the German air blitz of the American East Coast during the last days of World War II. They stared at each other uneasily and bunched closer together like small boys in a lightning storm or cows in a blizzard. There was a raw redness in that swelling sound of crowd, a hunger that was numbing. Garrity had a vivid and scary image of the great god crowd clawing its way out of the Augusta Basin on scarlet spider legs and devouring them all alive. The town itself had been swallowed, strangled, and buried. In a very real sense, there was no Augusta, and there were no more fat ladies or pretty girls or pompous men or wet-crotched children waving puffy clouds of cotton candy. There was no bustling Italian man here to throw slices of watermelon. Only crowd, a creature with no body, no head, no mind. Crowd was nothing but a voice and an eye. And it was not surprising that crowd was both God and Mammon. Garrity felt it. He knew the others were feeling it. It was like walking between giant electrical pylons, feeling the tingles and shock stand every hair on end, making the tongue jitter nuttily in the mouth,
making the eyes seem to crackle and shoot off sparks as they rolled in their beds of moisture. Crowd was to be pleased. Crowd was to be worshipped and feared. Ultimately, crowd was to be made sacrifice unto. They plowed through ankle-deep drifts of confetti. They lost each other and found each other in a sheeting blizzard of magazine streamers. Garrity snatched a paper out of the dark and crazy air at random and found himself looking at a Charles Atlas bodybuilding ad. He grabbed another one and was brought face to face with John Travolta. And at the height of the excitement, at the top of the first hill on 202, overlooking the mobbed turnpike behind and the gorged and glutted town at their feet, two huge purple-white spotlights split the air ahead of them, and the major was there, drawing away from them in his jeep like an hallucination, holding his salute ramrod stiff, incredibly, fantastically oblivious of the crowd in the gigantic throes of its labor all around him. And the walkers, the strings were not broken on their emotions, only badly out of tune. They had cheered wildly with hoarse and totally unheard voices, the 37 of them that were left. The crowd could not know they were cheering, but somehow they did. Somehow they understood that the circle between death worship and death wish had been completed for another year, and the crowd went completely loopy, convulsing itself in greater and greater paroxysms. Garrity felt a stabbing, needling pain in the left side of his chest and was still unable to stop cheering, even though he understood he was driving at the very brink of disaster. A shifty-eyed walker named Milligan saved them all by falling to his knees, his eyes squeezed shut and his hands pressed to his temples as if he were trying to hold his brains in. He slid forward on the end of his nose, abrading the tip of it on the road like soft chalk on a rough blackboard. How amazing, Garrity thought. That kid's wearing his nose away on the road. And then Milligan was mercifully blasted. After that, the walkers stopped cheering. Garrity was badly scared by the pain in his chest that was subsiding only partially. He promised that was the end of the craziness. "We getting close to your girl?" Parker asked. He had not weakened, but he had mellowed. Garrity liked him okay now. "About 50 miles, maybe 60, give or take." "You're one lucky son of a bitch, Garrity," Parker said wistfully. "I am?" He was surprised. He turned to see if Parker was laughing at him. Parker wasn't. "You're going to see your girl and your mother. Who the hell am I going to see between now and the end? No one but these pigs." He gestured with his middle finger at the crowd, which seemed to take the gesture as a salute and cheered him deliriously. "I'm homesick," he said, "and scared." Suddenly he screamed at the crowd, "Pigs! You pigs!" They cheered him more loudly than ever. "I'm scared too, and homesick. I mean, we, he groped. "We're all too far away from home. The road keeps us away. I may see them, but I won't be able to touch them." "The rules say..." "I know what the rules say, bodily contact with anyone I wish, as long as I don't leave the road. But it's not the same. There's a wall." "Fucking easy for you to talk. You're going to see them just the same."
"Maybe that'll only make it worse," McVries said. He had come quietly up behind them. They had just passed under a blinking yellow warning flasher at the Winthrop intersection. Garrity could see it waxing and waning on the pavement after they had passed it, a fearful yellow eye opening and closing.
"You're all crazy," Parker said amiably. "I'm getting out of here."
He put on a little speed and had soon nearly disappeared into the blinking shadows.
"He thinks we're queer for each other," McVries said amused.
"He what?"
Garrity's head snapped up.
He's not such a bad guy, McVree said thoughtfully. He cocked a humorous eye at Garrity.
Maybe he's even half right. Maybe that's why I saved your ass. Maybe I'm queer for you.
With a face like mine, I thought you perverts liked the willowy type.
Still, he was suddenly uneasy. Suddenly, shockingly, McVree said, "Would you let me jerk you off?"
Garrity hissed in breath.
"What the hell?"
"Oh, shut up," McVree said crossly. "Where do you get off with all this self-righteous shit? I'm not even going to make it any easier by letting you know if I'm joking. What say?"
Garrity felt a sticky dryness in his throat. The thing was, he wanted to be touched. Queer, not queer, that didn't seem to matter now that they were all busy dying. All that mattered was McVree's. He didn't want McVree's to touch him, not that way.
"Well, I suppose you did save my life."
Garrity let it hang. McVree's laughed.
"I'm supposed to feel like a heel because you owe me something, and I'm taking advantage? Is that it?"
"Do what you want," Garrity said shortly. "But quit playing games."
"Does that mean yes?"
"Whatever you want," Garrity yelled. Pearson, who had been staring, nearly hypnotized, at his feet, looked up, startled.
"Whatever you goddamn want," Garrity yelled.
McVree's laughed again.
"You're all right, Ray. Never doubt it."
He clapped Garrity's shoulder and dropped back. Garrity stared after him, mystified.
"He just can't get enough," Pearson said tiredly.
"Huh?"
"Almost 250 miles, Pearson groaned. "My feet are like lead with poison inside them. My back's burning, and that screwed-up McVree's doesn't have enough yet. He's like a starving man gobbling up laxatives."
"He wants to be hurt, do you think?"
"Jesus, what do you think? He ought to be wearing a beat me hard sign. I wonder what he's trying to make up for."
"I don't know," Garrity said. He was going to add something else, but he saw Pearson wasn't listening anymore. He was watching his feet again, his weary features drawn in lines of horror. He had lost his shoes. The dirty white athletic socks on his feet made gray-white arcs in the darkness. They passed a sign that said, "Lewiston, 32, and a mile beyond that, an arched electric sign that proclaimed, "Garrity, 47, in light bulb lettering. Garrity wanted to doze but was unable. He knew what Pearson meant about his back. His own spine felt like a blue rod of fire. The muscles at the backs of his legs were open, flaming sores. The numbness in his feet was being replaced by an agony much more sharp and defined than any that had gone before. He was no longer hungry, but he ate a few concentrates anyway. Several walkers were nothing but flesh-covered skeletons, concentration camp horrors. Garrity didn't want to get like that, but of course he was anyway. He ran a hand up his side and played the xylophone on his ribs. "I haven't heard from Barkovich lately," he said in an effort to raise Pearson from his dreadful concentration. It was altogether too much like Olson reincarnated.
"No, somebody said one of his legs went stiff on him coming through Augusta."
"That right?"
"That's what they said."